Uncut, a podcast where we explore faith in ways that might get you kicked out of most churches. I'm your host, Mike.
And I'm Amira.
Today, we are joined by a very special guest. I've been a longtime follower, fan, and first, I want to say thank you to Dr. Takiya Men for making this possible. She put the bug in my ear on the Faith Uncut group. She's followed the pod and has been a huge supporter, and I appreciate her for that, but now I appreciate her for this. The opportunity to sit down with the Reverend Dr. Monica A. Coleman, womanist, process theologian, brilliant scholar, and now she's here with us.
So yes, welcome, Dr. Coleman. Welcome.
Glad to be here.
Thank you for joining us. We can just kind of jump right into it. We've talked about so many different things on this show, and Mike is usually the one exposing me to different types of theology and just the information that he comes across from seminary. My background is history and government, so we kind of meet in the middle. So for the benefit of our listeners and also for myself, could you take a moment to explain what process theology is?
Yes, I can. I'll give you two versions of it. The simplest version is, in process theology, we believe that everything that happens is a result of three things: what we have to work with, or our past, what's possible in our given context, and then what we do with it. That's the simplest way of putting it. And for those of us who believe in God, those possibilities, they come from God. And process theology is a philosophical theology. Okay. Which means that we think about, how does the whole world work? And where is God within that idea? And so we believe that change is the most central thing that happens. That it, like, change is the only constant kind of idea.
Right. Mm-hmm.
If you believe that change is the only constant, and that's kind of the core of what you're looking at, then how do we think about the world? How do we understand science? How do we understand God? And process theology is one such way of incorporating the centrality of change into how we think about God and the world.
Excellent. So would you say that process found you, or that you came to it? Like, how did this become your path?
Well, process found me several times, and I said, no, thank you. And finally, I think I came to process. Like many people, I was exposed to it in seminary and theology school. And the first time I read it, I didn't understand it. For what it's worth, I still don't really understand that particular book. So it just wasn't written in a way that my brain works, I think. The second time, I'm not telling you. These books are written by my friends and colleagues.
I have a hunch, but we will talk about that later.
So the second book I read, to understand it, and I thought, so you want me to pray to a God who doesn't have the power to answer my prayers? I don't think so. And that was really how I read it. And then the third time, this is like literally first year, second year, third year, I'm at the end of my journey in divinity school, and by this time I had become a survivor of sexual violence, and I had become a community organizer working with survivors of sexual violence and survivors of domestic violence. And issues of suffering and evil were very real for me and for the people I worked with and cared about. And I was looking for ways to preach and teach about this in Nashville, the buckle of the Bible Belt. And so I took a course on preaching themes of suffering and evil. I actually audited it. And in that course, we read Charles Hartshorne's Omnipotence and Other Theological Mistakes. That was my conversion text. And I said, oh, we really need to think about God's power differently, because nothing from my traditions that I had inherited had given me a humane answer to why people were suffering this deep, intimate violence that was really no fault of their own. And something I didn't blame God, didn't blame the devil, didn't just something you could really say and hold on to and believe without feeling like you were crazy. And process is what let me live the life I really had, speak to people I cared about without checking my brain at the door.
One of the things you mentioned regarding how you were introduced regarding the suffering path and how you understood that. William Jones wrote a book called Is God a White Racist? In that book, he was challenging some of the liberation theology, and without getting into the guts of the challenge, one of the conclusions that he drew, he argued that any theological system must begin with a viable theodicy, or God's justice, how we interpret and understand the suffering in light of God. And so his argument does make sense, because you don't want to go too far down the road of building your Christology, your soteriology, and then all of a sudden you can't answer this theodicy question, because then you scrap your whole system. And so Jones contends that it must be the starting point. And so for you, it sounds like that was part of the starting point. So how does process address these issues of evil and suffering and theodicy?
Well, William R. Jones's point is great, especially the way he brings it up, because his critique is not just of Black liberation theologies. And it was written so long ago, he was really critiquing two or three thinkers in their early stages, right? James Cone and a couple others. And he says, well, if God is on the side of the oppressed and we're still oppressed, then God must not like us as Black people, right? If God is the God of Black people and God is on Black people's side and Black people are still kind of getting their butts kicked in the world, mm-hmm. then God must not like us. And that's a really good point. And so he does say that theodicy should be the starting point, but that's kind of, he's also coming at what James Cone and some other early Black theologians were saying, is that the experience of being Black is the experience of suffering and oppression. Now, I would disagree with that, actually. I think there's much more to the experience of Blackness and our cultural experiences and heritage than the experiences of suffering and oppression. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So in some way, he's going from where they're saying, he's like, but you need to do something with this God you got. Mm-hmm. And that part, I deeply agree with William R. Jones, because he's saying the current theological framework you have is not good for Black people. And I completely agree. It's not good for Black people. It doesn't turn out well. Do I believe God is on the side of Black people? I think God is deeply and wholeheartedly against injustice. Yes, in that sense. But when you give God all this power and then things still don't look good for how God is wanting the world to turn out, you have to say, well, what's going on here? And so it's not so much that I think that we should start with the experience of suffering. I think, you know, Alfred North Whitehead, who is a major process philosopher and thinker in whose lineage I follow, he says all religious dogma is shipwrecked on the problem of evil. So it's really that suffering and evil is that test. It's that thing that when we feel it, we start getting to the rock bottom base of what we experience, what we think, what we believe, we're laid out, it's terrible. And that's when we really see what works for us and what doesn't work for us. And so I think that's probably more where William R. Jones was coming from, that if you can't answer the questions of theodicy, you need a new theology. And he suggests that we have different ways of thinking about God and humanity than James Cone offers. And even though he doesn't use the language of process theology, I won't repeat his language because I don't like the way he frames it. We come out in the same place, right? Mm-hmm. He says you need either what he calls, I will say it, a weak humanism or a strong humanism. Mm-hmm. So my colleague Anthony Penn has really taken that seriously and gone towards strong humanism. And what Jones calls weak humanism is process theology. It is a way of thinking about God where we don't think about God's power as being authoritative, as if God can make things happen, but God's power is persuasive. And God can be incredibly persuasive, but we have real agency and we're not always persuaded. God calls and we could say yes or no, thank you. And that happens all the time. And when that happens with systems and structures of power, you see what we get. Mm-hmm. It also means we always have the opportunity in the next moment to say yes. And that is where the hope lies.
I feel like I'm in class. This is awesome.
Well, you're not. We're in class. She's the PhD. I'm just here. So if God is persuasive, how does process handle God's power? What are the limits of God's power in process theology, if that can be articulated? Because it sounds like, and I kind of know the answer to this, but it sounds like we're saying that a traditional view of an omnipotent God is not the process view.
Yes and no.
Okay.
It's, the traditional view of omnipotent God is not the process view, but we do believe that God is omnipotent. The question is, what kind of power are we talking about? In structures that are hierarchical, which are also often patriarchal and colonial, people believe that the highest form of power is a coercive power, an authoritative power, the power to make things happen, right? To effect change forcefully, unilaterally might be another way of putting it. We believe that the highest form of power is persuasive power, right? That your power is more lasting and more effective if you persuade somebody of the value of it and why it's good for them, and they are self-motivated, incentivized on their own to do X, Y, Z, than if you make people do things, right? So yes, I can, you know, have my students do this assignment, right? Because if they don't, they'll fail their punishments, right? Heaven, hell, A, F, right? Mm-hmm. Or, which is kind of how the structure is set up as a professor. Or if they are persuaded that this will be a good learning process for them and they care about their own growth and edification, then I have had a better influence on them, right? Than a reward or punishment system or a coercive system where I just make them do something. Because then if I'm out of the picture, they will still do it, right? So that is what we think persuasive power is a higher form of power. And that is the kind of power God has. So it's not that God has this strong authoritative power and limits God's self, which is what some theologies say, but rather that's not even the kind of God we have. That's not even the highest form of power. Yes, there are some forms of power that work that way, but wouldn't we want God to have the highest form of power? And isn't the highest form of power one that is persuasive and influential from the inside out?
The more I'm hearing you explain it, it really... It sounds like Octavia Butler was processed, because in the first book I read was Dawn in the Xenogenesis series. And she was saying, or the point was made, that one of the two biggest detriments to humanity was hierarchy. And then in Parable of the Sower with Earthseed, we see that it starts with change, as you're discussing. So it seems like this is. As you said, it's a philosophical theology that you can arrive at multiple ways. I mean, she arrived there through her fiction, which is based on life experience and observation. So it's amazing how all of this ties together.
Yes, yes, and yes, right? I mean, if you know my work, you know I love Octavia Butler's work, all of it, especially the Parable series, but all of her work. Tanana Reeve Dew and I lead the Octavia Try to Tell Us webinars. I wrote about Parable of the Sower in my 2008 book, Making a Way Out of No Way. But your observation is really kind of right along the lines where we're coming from, in the sense that we don't think we're making something up, right? We think we're looking around and this is how things seem to work. Whether you're looking at molecules, quantum physics, right? Psychology, human behavior, God, mm-hmm. right? We're trying to be descriptive. And for us in process, it's not like this is how it is, you got to get with it. It's more like we're trying to describe the world with all the knowledge we have. And if we learn more about the world and there's something different, then we change our theology. We don't, right? We don't change what we know. It is an open metaphysic, we says, right? Which means that we are flexible and open to learning more and changing our model. Because our model is just trying to be descriptive of what we think is happening. And that's really what, you know, Octavia Butler did. She was observant. She studied science. She looked around and said, this is what doesn't seem to be working. And this is what does seem to happen.
You probably don't remember this, because I don't know why you would. But when you were at Claremont, there was a summer series that you taught, and you taught process then. And I was actually able to take one of those courses, which was fascinating to me. And I kind of had a similar experience to what you described, where initially hearing it, I was like, no way, there's no way that works. And I went away and sat with it. And then I came back and was like, wait, okay, that kind of makes sense. And at first it was the omnipotent, omniscient God, because you also said some things about like how God can't know anything because God is constantly in change, I guess. So there's no way for God to know the future of everything, or can God know all of the possibility? I'm asking a question because this is a question I had in that class.
It is, it's, God doesn't know what we're going to do before we do it, okay. Right? So God doesn't know the future, because otherwise our agency wouldn't be real. We just think we're making decisions that are free, but they wouldn't, because God already figured them out. Mm-hmm. And then we're just puppets who think we're not puppets, right? So we don't think that God knows what's going to happen before it happens, because God is in this symbiotic relationship with us. God becomes part of who we are and affects how we make decisions, and we become a part of who God is and affects what God has to work with in the next moment, right? Which means we can't guarantee a happy ending. That bothers people. It bothers me, because it doesn't bother me theologically. It makes me sad that some people can just make some decisions and just screw the whole thing up. They can press the red button, you know, they can just do things that are selfish and destroy the world, destroy humanity. And God's like, well, I tried, people, but this is what you chose to do. And there'll still be other universes and multiverses and black holes to work with, maybe just not Earth. Right. I mean, so God and the world will still be there, maybe just not our world. Mm. So that is a little disturbing, but it's also exciting, because that means that the more great things we give God to work with, the more there is. Right. The more possibilities there are for justice and beauty and truth and art and adventure and all the great things that God is hoping for and envisioning, and just saying, come on, people, you can do it. You can do it. Let's do this together. Right. But yeah, so God does not know the future, but God does hold all the possibilities right within God's self, which is why we can be surprised, because God knows what's happening all the time. God doesn't know what's going to happen before it happens, but God does know what's happening everywhere. Right. So I don't know what I'm thinking. I don't know what's happening across the world in a small village in Central Asia, but God does. Right. So God is working with much more information than we're working with at any given moment. And God is factoring all of that in when God is calling us to the next moment. And so God can see possibilities that we can't see, because God's got more to work with than we have, which is why we can still be surprised and still say, wow, that seems like it came out of nowhere. It didn't come out of nowhere. It came out of God. It came out of possibilities. It came out of a world that we don't have access to. But there it is.
So what's interesting is the way you described it. It sounds like not only can we be surprised, but God is also surprised, because God can be surprised, because everything up until the future point, God won't know. God knows everything that's happening now and has happened, but God is discovering as we're discovering, or as we are, I guess, being, as the universe goes, God grows, kind of.
Yes, we would say becoming. We are always becoming. We're always having new experiences. We're always becoming something new, right? I mean, you've always had traditions like this, right? That behold, all things become new. Behold, I am a new creature, right? You never step in the same river twice. These are very ancient ideas that not only is change constant, but we have the chance to become something new in every moment. Well, same with God. Right? Because what happens in the world doesn't just affect God. God doesn't just know about it. It becomes part of who God is. It becomes part of God's becoming, so that what we do, and not we just people, you, me, and us three, right? But all what happens in the world, right, literally becomes at each moment part of who God is. And so, yes, God is surprised. God is growing. God has more and more new information to work with.
Okay. So, as a womanist process theologian, that is an even that's a niche that's really you own it. I mean, I don't know anyone else. But as womanist theology is a liberation theology, and the God of process is in partnership with us as we make the world into what it should be, or the universe into what it should be. How do you reconcile the liberation theological side with the process side, where that partnership exists?
Oh, well, for me, it's very easy. And there are other Black women who are interested in process. I'm talking about it and writing about it the most, you might say. And when I started, there weren't any, but I didn't know that, which is good. I might've been scared. But rather, I was like, this is cool. Let's go do this. I was like, wow, where are the Black people at? Mm-hmm. So I was surprised, but it didn't seem like an impossible thing to me, right? Because to do womanist religious work and scholarship means that you put this religious and spiritual experiences of Black women at the center of what you do, right? And there's a whole lot right there, right? You know, what do you mean by Black? What do you mean by women? What do you mean by religious and spiritual experiences? All of that is great and interesting and diverse, and we start there. Mm-hmm. Right. So that's what it means to be womanist. And as a liberative theologian and theology, as a liberative theology and coming from the liberation theology tradition, it means that we believe the telos of our work and God's work is justice, survival, wholeness, quality of life. Right. So in the most classical sense, liberation theology says God has a preferential option for the poor, right? Or God is on the side of the oppressed. And so that I don't say it that way, but I do come from kind of where womanists come from and say, God cares about not just our survival, but our survival, our wholeness, our quality of life and justice and freedom. And there's no conflict with process theology. I just have a different way of thinking about God and how God and the world interact than many womanist theologians, but not all womanist theologians. And so you can have a different model for God and still care about the centrality of Black women's religious experiences. I have a process model for God, and I start with the centrality of Black women's religious experiences. I happen to think that many of my conclusions are true for all people, but my starting point is Black women's religious experiences.
That's beautiful. So one of the things that I had a question, I mentioned having an issue with the omniscience and omnipotence of God, but I did figure that out because you taught me well. The thing that I didn't have, that I still had questions about, not because you're teaching, but because of my reluctance to accept the information, was the concept of evil in process. So can you explain a little bit how process deals with evil?
Yes. So the philosopher in whose lineage I work with, Alfred North Whitehead, right, says that all loss is evil. Mm-hmm. And that bothers us because we think of evil as a moral category, evil as being good or being bad. And for him, it's a philosophical category, right, which is a way of saying that evil is built into the system. Very classical views say that evil comes from outside the system. The system is good and evil enters, right? It comes through the Garden of Eden. It comes from a devil. It comes from some opposite thing. And we say, no, it doesn't. That loss is part of the system, that you cannot have change without having loss. You cannot become something new without losing something old. It's just part of what it means to change. And plenty of that change is morally neutral, actually. It's not good or bad. It just kind of is, right? You just become something new, and it's not necessarily better, just new. Not worse, just new. And some of that change is fine, but you still lose what you used to be. You still lose what was. And he said that's a kind of evil because we can't hold on to that. Now, again, Western philosophers are really bothered by finitude. They're really bothered by the fact that humans aren't superhumans, right? That we are not immortal, that we don't live forever. This really, really bothers Western philosophers. The fact that we die. This doesn't bother, for example, African theorists and religious people as much because death isn't the end for us. But for those in Western philosophy, they're still a little unsure about what happens at the end. So they're bothered by it. And so they're always trying to figure out, how do we address finitude? How do we overcome finitude, right? So for Whitehead, that is evil, right? It is a loss. But again, it's not a morally immoral category. So there are plenty of things that we lose, like bad habits, that aren't evil in the way we think of good and bad. And there are plenty of things that we lose that do hurt, things we lose that we shouldn't have to lose, right? Things that we lose in ways that hurt more than they should have, right? Things that where there's a great injustice about what we lose and how we lose it. And we do feel that in the way we would call bad or kind of moral evil. But for Whitehead, it's loss, right? And so he says that loss comes with feelings. It's kind of, it puts on clothes, right? Mm-hmm. Sometimes those feelings are feelings of suffering, but not always. And not all suffering is something that you would call evil. Like it might feel bad to lose a bad habit, to withdraw from a bad habit. to give up sugar, right? It doesn't feel good, mm-hmm. even though you're like, this is a good thing to do, as an example. Right. So there might be a little bit of suffering. That doesn't mean that it's morally bad, right? Not all suffering is what we would think of as morally bad or morally evil, but it is a kind of loss, right? And so we can, but this is what lets us get rid of bad things we want to get rid of, not just our personal habits, but societal ills, right? Cultural problems. Mm-hmm. Because there's loss, we can say, how do we lose this? How do we lose and get rid of some things? But the fact that we lose things when we don't want to lose them, we lose things when we shouldn't lose them, we lose them in deep and painful ways, that feels bad to people, right? But there's always going to be loss. Is always going to be lost. So the question, as a constructive theologian, and even her Whitehead comes, what do we do about that? What do we do about loss? How do we navigate it? How do we finesse it? How do we address it? He might say overcome, but I would say, what is our response? What happens in the midst of loss? Because we can't not have loss.
Okay, so during this time of unprecedented loss, I want to clarify, what do we call the thing between the losing, which we've termed as evil, or process terms as evil, and the thing that magnifies the loss, the thing that makes it 250,000 people dead instead of 10,000 people dead?
Again, it's that the fact that we are losing more than we needed to, more than we...
Seems wasteful.
Yes, more than we should have, given the resources available from both the past and what was possible. Mm-hmm. We would call that a kind of moral evil. Right? That is not good. I think it's fair to call it evil. There are times I think of it as sinister even, because the resources were available to do differently. Mm-hmm. The challenge in a process world is that we can't assume that God cares more about the well-being of humanity than the well-being of the virus, for example, right? Religious people, we like to think that God cares more about people than anybody else and than anything else. But we don't really know that. And that's why we have all these environmental and ecological theologians saying, hey, you can't just stomp all over the earth and do what you want. God cares about the well-being of trees and animals too, right? So how do we know that God doesn't care about the well-being of a virus? But a virus isn't trying to kill people, right? A virus is looking for a host. A virus is trying to live just like we are trying to live. Life wants to be alive. And it just so happens that the virus living often kills people, but the virus doesn't want to kill people, because if the person the virus is in dies, so does the virus, right? So the virus isn't trying to take people out. The virus is just trying to live. And the virus living is not really what's good for humanity at this point. But we do believe, and I deeply believe, as many process thinkers do, that God cares about the common good. And I think it is very easy to argue that the virus living and thriving does not actually contribute to the common good, not for the virus or for the people who are infected and affected with the virus.
Well, first of all, I've learned so much. And the thing about it is, I might not know the formal term for these ideas and these philosophies, but some of what you covered overlaps with things that I've learned with adult education processes. You know, why do we change how we behave and what we believe in as we age? Because we begin to rely on ourselves more so than external contributors for our own well-being, for securing ourselves. So a lot of this makes perfect sense to me now that it's been organized in a certain way. I thrive in a classroom environment, and this is kind of like a modified situation. The question that I have is that, you know, as you spoke about putting Black women in the center of your thought process, even as you think about process theology, notice that other marginalized groups who experience that centering, the output begins to change. The sermonizing sounds different. The messaging sounds different. So to the listener, what does process sound like coming from the pulpit?
Well, because process is not just what I study, it's what I believe. When I preach, I'm preaching process. When I write, I'm writing process, right? So I think that most people don't say, wow, that sounds like process theology.
No, they don't. But I think it's so eye-opening. except for Mike.
Which that makes my heart sing that you do. But I think people say, that sounds different. I've never thought of it that way before. That's what I usually hear. And that's probably both the womanist part and the process part, right? Mm-hmm. Because you're going to preach something differently if you're starting with, well, how have Black women experienced something like this? What might Black women have experienced in this context or that context if you're working with a particular holy scripture? You might not read from the person who won in the way the story is told, right? Which is what Dolores Williams does. Dolores Williams isn't reading from, right, Abraham and Sarah's perspective. Dolores Williams is reading from Hagar's
perspective, yeah.
Right? So how does it come out differently, right? I've done that with Dina in the past, right? We're usually reading about Genesis 34 from the perspective of the men who went to war. But what about the woman who was raped? What's her experience? What was she like? What would she need? Right. And that's because I learned biblical interpretation from Renita Weems and Fernando Segovia. And I thought that's what everyone did. But they taught me to listen for who doesn't have voice and to give them voice. And I think that's very much in consonance with what it means to center Black women's experiences. So if I'm preaching, that's part of what I'm bringing to the table. And the other part is to say, you know, how are God and humanity working together to create something? How should they be? How are they not doing it? What, you know, how do we need, you know, process is a deeply relational theology. So how are these pieces related in ways we haven't thought about before? And what does that mean for our responsibility as people, as well as what we see God doing? Or who is embodying the principles of God in particular texts? So those are the kinds of things I'm thinking of. But I think the response usually is, I've never thought of it that way before. Or it's probably based on the text I choose. So for example, for many years, and I'm giving it away because now I can't do it. No, I can't. I have preached a sermon about barren women. And there are barren women all over the Bible. But who preaches about what it means to be a woman who can't have children? Mm. And I've done that for a number of years. And there are always people who say, I've never heard anyone preach about my experience of infertility or pregnancy loss from a pulpit, even though it's all over the Bible, right? It's always about, and then God opened her womb and gave her a son. It's not about, what does it feel like to want something so badly and not be able to do it? And this is what society values, right? That's, you know, and to me, that's womanist and that's process and that's liberative.
Thank you.
Okay, so you're doing some great work trying to educate people on process theology, womanist theology. So what are some of the ways that people can connect and learn more?
Thank you for asking. You know, it is a passion of mine to kind of take the things that usually only graduate students get and share them with everybody. Do I want to make converts? Totally. Do I need? Not at all. You know, I really want people to know that there are lots of ways to think about their faith. And here's one of them that they might not have heard about before. So here it is. What do you think of it? And so I do teach courses on process theology, and you can learn more about that at processtheology101.com. And that's just available for anyone. So it's the fun parts of learning, all learning, no homework, right? No papers, just a chance to learn. And I don't have to grade papers either, so everybody's happy, right? Just a chance to learn about process theology. And I think it's really embedded in all the work that I do. So if you were to go to my website, MonicaAColeman.com. You could get access to a free 5-day devotional I do if you're looking for a devotional that just is a little bit different than what you may have heard of. I am also doing a free Advent devotional just because I thought it'd be kind of fun. And so you could get that at bit.ly/MonicaAdvent, capital M for Monica, capital A for Advent. And grab those free resources right there. And that's my way of just kind of taking some of the traditional ways in which we think about our faith and putting a process spin on it. And I kind of just call it, these are spirituality for real life.
And you are also a writer. You've written quite a bit. So
far. Oh, yeah. Buy the books.
Yeah. So a special plug. I've read most of them. I still got a couple that I'm still working through. But I've bought Making a Way Out of No Way more times than you need to buy a book.
Thank you. It's still in print. So you just want your book to stay in print. So thank
what I like about the book is you're taking concepts and the formatting of the book makes it easy to understand. It's consistent throughout the chapters. And so, you know, this piece is coming up next. And so that's accessible for a lot of people. It's a brilliantly written book, but it's also an exceptionally organized book. So I definitely recommend checking that out. And then are you on socials or what are you doing?
Oh yeah, I'm on the socials. You can find me on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Pinterest, and YouTube at Reverend Dr. Monica, R-E-V-D-R Monica.
All right. So thank you so much for clarifying this and actually just sharing this with people. Like, I really needed your voice to share this information with our audience who has questions like we have. And so thank you for taking the time to do this. This was a treat for me. Amira knows.
And me too.
Yeah.
I mean, you might get you kicked out of church.
Yes, it will. That's what we do. So thank you for joining us. We will see you next episode for Faith Uncut. I'm your host, Mike.
And I'm Amira.
For more on Faith Uncut, check us out at faithuncut.com.